Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
We'll do an intro at the end, shall we?
We'll do it now.
Okay, go on then.
I haven't got one of you.
No.
Well, welcome once again to our podcast, Jules and Jim's Joyride. And we're here today with what I can only describe as a legend.
A poet, an artist, a great man, a hero of modern Britain.
Yeah.
It is John Cooper Clarke.
There he is.
All of those things and more.
Yeah.
what accent was
and
that?
And then some.
Yes, and then
and some.
And then some. We were just discussing Burt Lancaster.
Whose real name was Burt Wankfaster.
According to you.
According to me.
No wonder he changed his name.
Yes.
But he was, you were saying he's B-U-R-T.
He's B-U-R-T. So where does that, John, do you have any idea where that comes from? Because it's not short for Albert, is it? Because that would be, most Burts are B-E-R-T. But Burt.
He's from Lancashire. Burt. Burt Wankfaster.
Well, there we are.
And then he went off, talking of people from Lancashire who went to America, Butch Cassidy apparently was born in Lancashire, went to America to rob trains, and he had such a strong Lancashire accent, no one could understand him.
Is that true?
So, get up, right, Lancashire, right, get up a train and get up more. But they couldn't understand him.
No, I mean, like, so I'm finding it hard to understand.
All the train would be going, pardon?
You say that, but it must have been pretty obvious. Once somebody's got a mask and they're pointing a gun, yeah. I mean, it's pretty obvious what they
but
want.
They, yeah, they, and apparently they couldn't understand.
They all pretended they couldn't, because they didn't want to. Oh, sorry, we don't understand you. We pretend not, so they don't have to hand their valuables over.
Yeah.
I mean, that's that old ploy.
But anyway, that nicely leads us in to our travel motif.
Yes, it is very. It's a very thin motif.
Robbery on trains.
Have you ever robbed a train, John?
What, by hiding in the lavatory when they come round to look for the tickets, you mean? Does that count as robbing trains?
I suppose so, yes.
Robbing the railways.
Malcolm Hardy's trick was to say to someone who'd gone into the lavatory, tickets, please, just put your ticket under the door. And then he'd take the ticket and go off with it and use it.
What's your favourite method of transport? Car by car?
Yeah, I consider the hours I spend in the passenger seats of an automobile to be golden.
Yes, nice.
Yeah.
But how do you while the time? Do you look out the window? What's going on? Or are you busy reading, writing?
Oh no, look out the window. You can get sick, can't you? Reading in a forward moving vehicle, you know. So no, I look out the windows.
Have you ever been locked in the boot of a car?
No, that's an intelligent question. No, I haven't. I have been kidnapped, but not in the boot of
a
car.
What happened when you were kidnapped then?
I was kidnapped by a doctor in Switzerland, actually.
For what purpose?
It's a really long story to do with narcotics, to be honest. But it was a very friendly kind of kidnapping, in which case he could sort of sort me out for my entire stay. So we had this kind of Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson kind of relationship whereby everywhere I went, it was accompanied by this tame doctor with, the little black bag and everything. So it was all...
So it wasn't a real kidnapping?
Not really, no. He'd cancelled, but he took the liberty of cancelling... He met me at the airport. He took the liberty of cancelling my hotel in order to look after me for my entire stay.
I mean, there is a boundary line between kidnap and befriending, isn't there?
There is.
You know, it's a thin line sometimes.
The worst thing I could say about him was that he was an enabler. yes. as they say at the Betty Ford Clinic. But I was very glad of it at the time.
So when did you first realise that it was a life of being a poet and a traveller? When did that dawn on you that you realised you could do that for a living? Did you have a horrid other jobs before you?
I did, yeah, but it was always my intention to be a professional poet for a living.
Oh, that is very good. What, from what age?
From the when I realised it was the only thing I was really any good at. Mm. When I left school, I got a job as an apprentice motor mechanic.
Really?
Yeah, that was my first job. But they used to put you on, if you were sort of on an apprenticeship, you'd go through a sort of what they call a probationary period, so they could see whether you had any aptitude in this realm of operation. You know, they give you a bit of a trial period. So we reached an agreement that I wasn't really cut out for this sort of work. You know, I like cars, but only because of what they look like and, you know, the in-car furnishings. And
so forth, yeah.
And, you know, all that flaky stuff. You know, I wasn't really interested in under the hood.
Exactly,
it wasn't really suitable. Then I came to a sort of agreement with my mum. My brother had just been born, he was about three at the time, and my mum got a job at a local confectioner's. And I come to an arrangement whereby I looked after our kid, my brother Paul, while she went to work. But sooner or later, if you're kind of working age and there didn't seem to be anything wrong with you and you were around in the daytime, you know, it soon became apparent that you weren't, like, in gainful employment. And I don't know about you, but I've always been susceptible to public opinion on a neighbourhood level. Do you know what I'm saying? I'm a neighbourhood kind of guy. So it started off, not got a job yet, John.
Yeah.
No, still looking, you know, it's terrible, the state of employment at the moment. A lot of people, you know, blah, 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 blah. My sympathy... Anyway, their sympathy soon turned to kind of, not got a job yet. So I started to feel the sort of pressure.
Yeah.
You know, that, here I am around in the daytime.
You couldn't have lied and said, well, yeah, I'm just... I'm the chairman of Shell, but I'm only going once a week.
Well, I did lie, but the lie turned into a reality. It gained its own momentum. What I said to him was, I'm trying to get into the printing trade, which it was well known that it was very difficult to break into the printing trade at that time. It was kind of... not what you know, it's who you know kind of situation. So they were all very sympathetic then, you know, like, here's a guy with ambition.
Yeah, it's been thwarted.
You know what I mean? Oh, it's notoriously difficult, John. Good luck with that.
Yeah.
Instead of, a job yet.
So you turn that around,
So I turned around, but I got into printing. I sat all the exams. I thought I might as well make it look good. So I sat all the exams to get in printing. And I became, I had to wait for a bit. For an opening, but I became a compositor back in the days of lead type.
Ah.
You know, at that point, the printing trade hadn't changed for 500 years or 300 years or whatever. Mm. But then computers came in and it was a sort of obsolete.
Well, that was quite handy. So you could say to the neighbours, oh, computers have come, I'm out of work again.
That's right, yeah. So again, you know, I could gain the sympathy of my neighbourhood.
So did you typeset your poetry?
Yeah, I did. Of course I did, yeah.
And
yeah,
make
yeah.
books?
Just to get an idea of what it would look like in a book. Long story short, I was always determined to be a professional poet.
You told me once, John, that but you had an early experience with Bernard Manning.
Yeah, he's the first guy to ever give me cash money for doing what I do.
Oh, that's an amazing story. Yeah, yeah. What happened there then?
You know, obviously I tried to get publishing deals that were all, you know, rejected. Why would they? I've never made them any money. Why would they be interested? So I started reading about Baudelaire anyway on the strength of, you know, the Edgar Allan Poe connection, and I found out that he did readings for public recitals of his work. Got a kind of fan base kind of thing back in the mid-19th century, so I thought, why not now? There weren't obviously any poetry venues. There was no scene for it.
What year are we talking about?
It was sort of just after I left school, you know. I mean, even when I got that first job, I thought, this ain't what I really what I want to... Yeah, I want to be a professional poet, even then, you know what I mean? But and the more... So I thought, as there are no venues for poetry, the more incongruous the venue, the better. So I thought, well, it's some sort of tradition of poetry and show business. You know, if you go back to the music halls,
yeah.
You know, there was loads of monologue artists.
Yeah.
The one that comes to mind, the most successful of them all, being Stanley Holloway, who made it in, you know, other areas as well. But he was a monologue artist at first, wasn't he, doing
and Albert, he used to
Albert and the Lion.
Yeah, exactly.
Brown Boots. He did that. He did. He even did them in northern dialects and that. You know, very, very skilled.
Yeah.
Very skilled at it. So I sort of had him as a bit of a template. I thought there's a place for poetry in the show business world. So, long story short, I got a gig for a left wing newspaper, a benefit gig. So I said to my dad, "Hey, I'm doing a recital tonight. You know, I've got a public recital on." He says, "How much are you getting for that?" I said, "It's a benefit for a magazine. Everybody's performing for nothing." You know, Christy Moore was on it for a start. Everybody's doing it for nothing. He says, "Well, anybody will employ you for nothing." So I thought, well, that's, you know, he's right there. He was right about a lot of things, my old fella. And so I thought, what would impress my dad? Who in show business would impress my dad? And I thought, well, there was only one answer to that. Bernard Manning, my dad,
of course.
A regular at the Embassy Club and what have you. And so I went round to the Embassy Club and in the afternoon. And
that's in Manchester, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Bernard's club. And he was knocking around there and I gave him my pitch. And I'd just written this number called Salome, which was about a punch-up in a dance hall where this chick gets killed, you know. Anyway, I thought, he knows that world. Because Bernard Manning started out as a singer with the Oscar Rabin Band. You know, he's a proper singer, Bernard. And he saw the end of that world, you know. They were booked up 18 months in advance when he quit the band, you know. And Bernie went up to Oscar, he says, "I'm just giving you my notice. I'll honour the next 18 months' gigs and then I'm getting out." He says, "What, you're joking? We've never been doing any better than this. You know, this is as good as it gets for us, you know. And now you're leaving? What's going on?" And he says, and Bernard says, "It's finished for this kind of music. Haven't you heard that Elvis Presley?"
Oh.
And that's when, you know, so his finger on the pulse guy, Bernard, you know what I mean? And that's when he got out. Yeah. He was dead right, you know.
So he left and started doing
He left
comedy.
On the strength of hearing Heartbreak Hotel.
Yeah, don't need any more, I'm out.
Yeah. They won't be going for this stuff anymore. So that's what... Because at first he says, "Don't waste your time. They don't like poetry in here, kid. Half of them can't fucking read." And then, so then I hit him with this one. "No, it's nothing highfalutin, Mr. Manning. You know, it's... for instance," so I give him that, you know, "she fell her first stiletto. When the ambulances came, she was lying on the deck. She fell her first stiletto heels and broke her fucking neck." He says, "All right, that'll do. All right, then I'll give you 20 minutes. So I give you 20 minutes.
So I had to do
a couple of numbers, a few gags, and then introduce the next act.
What was the general gist of Salome?
It's about, you know, secrets. She had a number on her back and sequins on her tits, the sartorial requirements for women in the Ritz. You know, it's a kind of a... I painted a vivid picture.
Yeah, and she got murdered.
One that I knew that he would recognise. Well, a punch-up breaks out. And she falls foul of a stray fist or something and falls off her stiletto heels and breaks her fucking neck.
But then but the gig went well, so did Bernard...
I wouldn't say it went well. No, I wouldn't say that. Well, it wasn't an instant success. I was met with wall-to-wall indifference, which is your greatest enemy as a poet, you know. Not hostility. Hostility can work in your favour, but indifference, is that's your enemy.
And what did Bernard say after the show?
But after that, I got loads of gigs at cabaret places all over Manchester. Once I told them I'd done the Embassy Club, it was like, bloody hell.
Didn't you walk in the office and didn't you interrupt him halfway through a sentence? It's just something you told me once. I'm trying to remember what it was. He was on the phone to somebody or something. I can't think.
Yeah, it's a bit of a routine. Yeah, that's right. I was waiting to get paid outside Bernard's office and I could hear him chewing out one of the previous acts. And he was saying that when you said you were going to saw a woman in half, I'd assumed you were a magician.
Because I remember seeing you supporting punk bands all up and like everywhere.
Yeah,
you were always
yeah.
on with everyone.
That's right, I was on with everyone, yeah, that's right, yeah. Well, I was an easy ride for them, you know, because there was nothing to shift off the stage, you know, there was no kind of, you know, I was a sort of godsend to them, really.
And then so how did you get about in a van? On your own?
No, originally I was driven around by Martin Hannett in a lease hire Volvo.
The producer?
Yeah.
Yeah. So why was Martin Hannett driving you around?
So I heard all those Joy Division records about a year before everybody else, you know, in work in progress, on the old cassette, in the in-car cassette.
And he'd drive you around, presumably, because he had bands on?
No, he was sort of part of my management at the time as well.
So, and was did you, once you were the punk thing, did mainstream showbiz have any sort of put its tentacles out towards you during that period, the punk period?
No, not at all. But the way mainstream show business sort of validated what I did, the thing that got everybody off my back really about poetry not being a reliable engine of wealth and all that, you know, I didn't have an argument against that until the success of Pam Ayres on Opportunity Knock. And then I could point to somebody that was actually cleaning up. You know, what's the difference, me and her? She writes about her world, I write about mine. We're doing the same gig, really.
I mean, I can't think of anybody apart from you who's like a poet who would do gigs in the music world and people would love, because people do love you. You've got a great following of people, you know.
Yeah, I suppose that. There's a lot of accuracy in that, Jules. Yeah, I've always sort of follow the crowds, innit? Follow the money. Follow the crowds. You know what I mean? That's why it seemed like a very good idea to enter the world of punk rock. I love a circular conversation, and it was Howard Devoto that convinced me to get into that world. You know, because he said, like, you already look the part. So I already kind of fitted in because I didn't wear... There was only two rules, weren't there? No beards, no flares.
I haven't got flares on.
Sorry, Jim.
I'm not wearing flares.
They were the only two rules, weren't they, though?
Although I did, at that time, have a pair... Or I didn't have any straight-leg trousers.
Bicycle
clothes. I had flares. But I did find a lot of safety pins on the floor. Because I went to very early punk gigs and I found a lot of safety pins discarded. So I employed them to tighten up my flares.
But of course, and really the other thing was that you were responsible for, is which happened in the punk thing, which was where swearing, which had been completely out on recordings, unless they were sort of underground records or in anything before, suddenly in punk records, well, the first record I played on was Fuck Off by the Electric Chairs, suddenly that word has come in. And you had that amazing poem... which was fucking this and fucking that.
Evidently like, chickens. So,
yes, yeah. I mean, an amazing poem, but it was like a noted work.
Yeah.
But was more swearing in it than any other poem that I could have thought of. A work of genius. Well, but did you have problems with that sort of thing?
Well, I had a problem getting on Death Row Records with that one.
Because before that,
some people just have to push it too far.
Yeah.
Before that, you had Philip Larkin, didn't you? Yeah. Philip Larkin was the only one.
Oh, he did, yeah. They fuck you up, your mum and dad.
And that was it. That's when it. You got that in, I remember at school saying, can we have Philip Larkin, please? always, to get a teacher.
I always misunderstood it. I always thought it was they tuck you up, your mum and dad.
That's probably what you're teaching.
Yes. That's been used, that one, Jules, yeah. Actually, by a contemporary of mine, Martin Newell. That's the first line of one of his poems. Yeah, yeah. They tuck you up, your mum and dad. Great minds think alike.
Very good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But yeah, the F word. In fact, when I wrote that, it was bloody, and it's that on the, you know, bloody this and bloody that, because I pinched it off an old army tune, the bloody flicks are bloody. It's written by a squaddie that was stationed in the Orkney Islands in the war. The bloody flicks are bloody old, the bloody seats are bloody cold. You can't get in for bloody gold in bloody Orkney.
And if you could give us a little bit of your one to get a similar meter, yeah, so yeah. Your one was.
Bloody this, the bloody trains are bloody late, you bloody wait and bloody wait, bloody lost, bloody found, stuck in fucking chicken sound. But when I did it in the States, just soon after I wrote it, I went out to did a show in New York, the Mud Club, and I was just about to launch into it, and I thought, bloody, it ain't even a cuss word in the States, is it? You know,
no, they're not supposed to know what it
means. So I thought, I better change it to fucking, you know, the international cuss word. And then when I did, why didn't I write it like this in the first place? And the reason I wrote bloody, I thought maybe it'd get some airplay. But I still kept stuck in fucking chicken sound, but I thought they can beat that. But I thought they'd be all right.
How did you go in America?
But it never got played anyway, so, you know, I shouldn't have played it so safe. Fucking, it should have always... Fucking, it's miles better. It's more percussive. It's got harder consonants.
Yeah. It is percussion, isn't it? Yeah.
And did they get you in America?
Sort of gets lost, doesn't it? Blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? It's not a good word. Fucking, it should have been... My mistake. So when I did it... So I've since I first did it in New York, I've always done it fucking...
And they get you in America, do they?
Yeah, sure. You know, it's a great opportunity. The great thing about going to the States is that I can speak with an American accent.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Could you give us an illustration?
Yeah.
Give us an illustration of your American accent.
I'll spring it on you. Okay. Like, I just can't think of anything to do anyway. But you know, I'm good at it. I can you know, carry on a whole conversation like this. But yeah, it's a great. Nobody going to call you out. But I found out very early on. It's much easier to adopt an American accent than to keep explaining where you. You know, hey, you're from England. You know, but you don't sound like a Cockney.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm from Manchester. It's in the north of England. You know.
Yeah.
You know
I mean? I've done that when I've been there. It's easier.
It's easier.
And they always start saying, "I'm an idiot if I am at you," and all of that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's easier just to put to an effect
an American accent.
Just when you're ordering food or something simple like that. Because otherwise, you do.
People do it when they sing.
Yeah.
You know, you can't sing most. Elvis. Rock and roll songs cannot be sung in an English accent, can they?
Americans have a very limited idea of what the British are like, and they're either very posh or the Cockneys,
and there's
nothing else.
That's it.
Because
the Beatles, or you like, you know, the Liverpool. Are you from Liverpool? So, you know.
Well, we're informed entirely by America, because we have American TV. They don't have any British TV as a reference point. So all they've got is old stories from the War of Independence.
Are you a tourist when you're on tour? Could you go and look at sort of museums and ancient sites? Or...
No, not really. I'm a great one for, you know, arriving at the hotel early. I like the whole thing, eh?
You get to the hotel and stay there.
Yeah, 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 until it's showtime.
So Jules and I...
Watch telly.
Just get out and do a full tourist trip.
Yeah, we'll sort of sketch corners of the city.
You do this, don't you? Because you're a sketcher.
I like getting out and doing, like, a whistle-stop tour of wherever I am and drinking it all in.
Yeah, I can dig that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't do that. So you couldn't say what your favourite city is?
Chicago. I like it there. I like all the places in the States.
But you haven't seen much other than the hotel.
I've only really seen the coast. I've been to Chicago and...
What did you like about Chicago?
Well, I went to Chess Records and it was great.
Right?
I was in a cab, you know, just going, doing a radio thing. And then I, by chance, looked up at Michigan Avenue. I said, take me, is it 2120, isn't it?
Something I can't remember.
I said, can you take me to number 2120, Michigan Avenue, you know? And he said, what, Chess Records? I said, yeah, you got it. And he says, you wouldn't be the first person who asked me to go there. So so that was great. I mean, I do that in the States. I walk around places in the States.
Yeah,
you know, it's that's another thing.
And how did you find Chess Records?
It's like a shop, isn't it? I mean, you must have been. No?
Yeah, a while ago, but yeah,
it's like a shop. You just knock on the door. It's not like the Blues Museum or anything. It's Willie Dixon's grandson that runs the.
Is gym. It because his? Is it really? That's good because his daughter ran the Blues Foundation, and unfortunately, she passed away.
I didn't say Willie Nelson then.
No,
Willie Dixon.
Willie Dixon, who is one of the greatest writers of all time,
yeah,
of course.
That's right.
But and of course, they all had great cars. Those blues artists.
Cars.
Oh, great cars. Those Cadillacs and Buicks and all of that. Oh, really great.
Yeah, fabulous.
Orbans and what have you. Have you ever fancied an American car?
Sure have, yeah. Yeah, I love those cars. Yeah. You got any?
Yeah, I used to have a few of those old Stingrays and loved them. Oh, great shape. They'll never make cars that look like that ever again. They look like rocket ships.
You had a Buick, right?
I did have a Buick, yeah.
Right, this fella came up to me and he told me this story before, but he said, did you ask Jules about this story? And I said, what? He says, when we were kids, some other kids had nicked the Buick sign off your car and we went and chased the kids and got it back for him.
Oh, that's very nice of him.
So I said, no, I forgot to mention that, but I will do. And now I've done it officially.
Well, thank you. Thanks to everybody involved.
If I was going to have an American car, I'd have the really square Ford Bronco.
From what year?
I think it's
like
early
70s.
Or late 70s, but it really does look like if you got a fool to design a car.
What, like that Homer Simpson one?
It's just a drawing of a car.
The bubble domes.
You know, you get a couple of squares and draw a car.
Two
wheels and a dome.
Oh, but I think it looked brilliant. And a kind of light sky blue. Beautiful. Because you can have... I mean, I do like all the... You know, I like the shape of all the great things. Yeah. But that one just looks like a drawing.
In an alternative career, you would have been a car designer. John, any alternative career?
I made it just out of... Say, here's three blocks of Lego, design a car.
Yes, make a car out of that shape. If it had been an alternative career for you, John, what would it have been, do you think? Was there another job you'd have liked to have had? I mean, would you want to be an actor that was James Bond, a train driver, an astronaut?
Advertising copywriter.
Oh, yeah? What sort of slogans would you like to...
I can't think of anything right off the top of my head. But I'm always inventing businesses.
Like
a slogan to go with it. There was one for Noodle Bar, an in-and-out noodle bar. Two doors, one in... One out.
When you said noodle bar, I just imagined that you were talking about a chocolate bar that incorporated noodles within it, which is quite horrific.
An energy bar with compressed noodles. A takeaway, a noodle takeaway. You go in one door, out the other, and select your...
Noodles.
What sauce you're going to have on the noodle, but only noodles. Anyway, it was going to be one in every town, the Nippon Inn.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Well, we were talking about Liverpool earlier on, because you were talking about Liverpool Cathedral, which is, I think, a fantastic bit of architecture.
Yeah, it's terrific, yeah.
Do you like it?
Yeah, I do. I like it for the Stations of the Cross, which were...
On the inside,
the work of Arthur Dooley.
Arthur Dooley, the docker.
Yeah, he was a docker, but he's been dead a long time now. But he was a proper hard nut, you know. He was a conflicted guy. He was a devout Catholic and also a member of the Communist Party. So he was a conflicted sort of guy. And he was a welder on the docks. And he went to an art gallery and saw some abstract stuff and thought, why not me? And he started welding up bits and pieces, you know, and he got a reputation as an abstractionist, and then got the gig of doing the Stations of the Cross at the Modernist Cathedral. In
well, it goes to show you, though. I mean, it's like you, if anybody's listening and thinking, well, I want to do this, just do it. If you want to do it. Like you thought, well, I want to be a poet, but you didn't know anybody that could. There wasn't anybody else being a poet, really, doing what you do. So you sort of invented you and your job.
People do invent what they are.
So if somebody's listening wants to invent what they are, that's okay. So within a certain level, but then if you go to beyond that, it can become what's known as fraud. But if you can really just be what you want, can't you? Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But without any education like Arthur Dooley does, you know, when you go into something brand new without having any preconceived ideas, that's when you come up with new genius ways of looking at things.
Yes, when I suggested that I was the new engineer on some great tunnelling project.
Yeah.
But I don't know anything about engineering on tunnels. So was it a good idea to have me? I don't know. But I might come up with a different way of looking at tunnelling.
There's a great skill in having a tunnel that's maybe like the Channel Tunnel. It starts in England and starts in France. Mm. And getting them to join up in the middle.
Yes.
So if it was me, they'd be about 3 miles apart when they but there'd be two tunnels because they'd never join up.
Yeah, so it's quite good. There'd be more tunnels, which would be useful. I did read. I wish I could think of his name. The obituary of the one. He was a great engineer who did design, I think, the Channel Tunnel and some of the great tunnels. And he became all around Europe. He was the main engineer. And I wish I could think of his name. But it had a picture of him in his obituary, and it said he was proud to be known all over the world for his boring technique.
His what?
His boring technique.
I thought he said ballroom.
No, boring. Boring technique, because he would bore tunnels.
He's boring. Yes. Now I'm with you, yeah.
Yeah.
His boring attitude to life as well. And when I was in... I was going to tell you this before, I just forgot, reminded me. When I was right next, staying at a hotel next to the cathedral in Liverpool.
Hope Street.
And I was on my own. I don't know, it was a big hotel, but I was on my own, and all of the Motown crew... We're on tour there, so I got Percy Sledge on, wasn't it, and the Temptations over here, and Smokey Robinson in America. Anyway, they were all there, and I was sitting right in the middle of the canteen having breakfast, and they were all on the outside like a wagon wheel, and I was the hub. And they were all saying, "Where you going today, Percy Sledge? I thought I'd go and see the cathedral. What about you, Smokey Robinson?" And like, they were having this conversation right over the top of me. So it was, I felt like I was in the middle of a war zone with missiles of interest flying over my head from Motown stars.
Wow, what a place to be.
Now, there's an image.
Yeah, that is an image.
But also, they're great tourists.
Yeah.
You see?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were all there going... And then I went off to see the cavern... Which I was a bit disappointed.
Two doors up from where it actually was, isn't it?
It's all... That's totally tourist-defined now, isn't it? So you get a bobbled John Lennon nodding dog.
It's a remake anyway, isn't it? It's on the same street, but it's about three doors up from where it was, isn't it?
And it's all... Every shop has got, you know, Beatles memorabilia.
Can't blame them for that.
Mugs and stuff. Well, no, you can't blame them. And as I was walking past, this bloke's going, "Steve! Steve!" And then he kept doing it, and I turned around and he went, "You're ignoring me then?" "Yeah, because I'm not Steve."
And what did he say to that?
I can't remember. I think I then ran off. I thought I was disillusioned by the whole experience.
That's like that one of Bernard's gags, that. He says, Bernard managed my late employer. He says, I was walking down Rochdale Road. I could hear this voice behind me. "Mark, Mark, Mark." Look round, nothing. "Mark, Mark, nothing. Mark, Mark." Checked again. turned out to be a bulldog with a hair lip.
Well, I think on that bombshell.
Yeah, on that note, I think we should sign off.
Yes, thank you very
Apologies
much.
Apologies to anybody with a hair lip.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Especially bulldog.
Thank you very much for joining us on the Joyride today. It's been a great pleasure and an honour having you here. John Cooper Clarke.
John Cooper Clarke, thank you.
My pleasure all the way, chaps. Anytime.
Well, that was nice. There goes John Cooper Clarke.
Yes.
The punk poet. But it's beyond punk now, isn't it? He's entered into the future.
You can't be a punk at my age.
You've gone by this way, so you can't talk.
Oh, well, sorry.
That's you walking off.
That's amazing, though. He's the first guest ever to have done that, to come back when they've gone off, to return from the netherworld.
This podcast was produced by Molly Stewart
and engineered by George Latham and Mike Boddy.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.